There we go.
All right. So welcome, and I apologize for being a few minutes late in getting here. The elevators had me stuck while I was waiting for some insulation to move, be pushed on and come back up. So they asked me to come in and talk to you about overall sort of rickettsial disease today. It's kind of late in summer, but why not? Maybe you've seen some, maybe not. But we'll sort of cover a more broad rickettsial sort of thing. We'll cover many of these sort of little atypical pathogens. For those of you that haven't met me before, I'm Lewis Weiss, and I'm in the Department of Infectious Diseases in medicine, and I'm also in the Department of Parasitology and Tropical Diseases, which is in pathology, since it's a laboratory medicine service. And why don't we go down? So, the colors are obviously going to be off. This looks yellow to me. So, it's your projector, not my slides. So, don't worry about it. When you see the images, the fact is very few of you are going to be looking under microscopes and doing diagnosis that way anyway. So, what are the rickettsia? Why should we bother about them? Why should we care? So, most of the rickettsia are zoonotic diseases. And beyond the rickettsia, there are Ehrlichia or the anaplasmosis, as many of you are probably now aware, the rickettsia that infects humans in our area, human granulocytic ehrlichiosis, which is has been renamed as anaplasma, and I'll show you that when we get to it, although there still is the monocytic ehrlichiosis, Ehrlichia schaffinensis, which is still in the Ehrlichia species. But these are relatively small organisms. The rickettsia are obligate intracellular bacteria, but they are bacteria. They do have cell walls. They, respond to bacterial-type antibiotics, but they are obligate intracellular pathogens. I'm going to show you, there's an enormous number of them. I mean, if you really start to go into the rickettsia, the Ehrlichia and all that, I mean, one can come up with all sorts of rickettsia worldwide that infect humans in different parts of the world. But we're going to try and put this down to some pathophysiology, which is how do I recognize a rickettsial infection or what might it look like, as much as trying to get at a specific rickettsial diagnosis, which one gets at through serology and sometimes through culture. In terms of the fact that they're zoonotic, most of them are transmitted by some sort of bite, and for the majority of them, we're talking about ticks or tick-like organisms, although, as you can see, typhus is transmitted through fleas, and, epidemic typhus is transmitted through louse feces. So there's several other sort of insect vectors of the rickettsia, but the ones that we tend to see around in our neck of the woods for the most part are tick or mite-borne. And we have the classic Rocky Mountain spotted fever, rickettsia rickettsiae, which is really kind of a misnomer in that it's really in highest concentration in the southeastern United States, not really in the Rocky Mountains. Gets its name, and actually the Rocky Mountain, the original rickettsial lab in the United States was located in the Colorados because there was basically a mountain range where you went down into the valley and you got rickettsia, but you were up, you were fine, and that sort of is where it was first recognized. We have things like rickettsia pox, which was first recognized, anyone know where? Kew Gardens, Queens. And first discovered by an exterminator, and I'll show you a little bit of that story in a bit, who was visiting houses in the 1940s. But, this also in the rickettsia. Then we have classic typhus groups and so on. Next slide. So let's go through some of these, but let's talk a little bit about pathophys, where these things live, and a little bit about how that may give you clues for the diseases. Now, most of these are febrile, ill-defined illnesses. So this is in the differential of someone who comes in with fever. They can look like they have a viral syndrome, but it's the differential diagnosis of a fever for most of these. With many of them, it's fever and rash. And that's the classic presentation of rickettsia. However, 10%, 15% of rickettsial disease presents spotless, so-called spotless spotted fevers and so on. So that the absence of a rash in the right season, the right epidemiology doesn't allow you to sort of say, oh, there's no chance that this is a rickettsial disease. Now, these are somewhat complicated pathophys figures, but they're somewhat useful in terms of thinking a little bit about where these organisms are. So the important thing for the rickettsia is really that one word down here, endothelial cells. Most of the rickettsia are endothelial cell pathogens. Now, many of them get in through phagocytosis, they break out, Orienta pseudogamushi buds out of its cell, it doesn't really matter in pathophys, classic typhus lyses, rickettsial fever goes out by sort of hijacking the cell machinery to propel itself out on actin filaments, that's fine. The end result is that the escape from the phagocytome and the final exit from endothelial cells does what? It breaks the endothelial cells. It damages the endothelium. So an overall trait of all of the rickettsia will be that endothelial cell damage. Now, all of you are far enough along in your career that you know what endothelial cell damage is going to mean. So you should be able, from knowing that the rickettsia are endothelial cell pathogens, in your head begin to concoct what classic rickettsial disease might look like. First off, if you damage the endothelial cells, what do you think is going to happen to the rash of rickettsia? What's it going to be like? Oh, you can talk louder than that. I don't have my large stick. They couldn't find it for me for pointing in that. But it's going to be a rash that's petechial, because petechial rashes, right, damage to endothelium, leakage of blood out of small capillary vessels, right, petechial rash is due to endothelial cell damage. So that what are the characteristics of a petechial rash that would be a rickettsial type rash, say, other than a drug rash, the classic one, if it's petechial? Right, I heard in the back, non-blanching. Right, so if you damage the endothelial cells, you leak out of the endothelial cells, the rash that develops when you put a slide on it or a glass plate or whatever you want to use, the end of your stethoscope, I guess if it's transparent, it's not going to blanch away because it's not a dilatation of vessels, it's not an erythema, it's an actual damage to the endothelium. What else, if you damage the endothelium, might you expect? What happens in vasculitis? So rickettsia is an infectious vasculitis. What happens in vasculitis? What laboratory markers might you expect? Now, sed rates in any oral infection, sed rates are up. Endothelial cell damage causes what? Right. Endothelial cell damage causes the platelets to clump on the endothelial cells. Thrombocytopenia is a hallmark of rickettsial diseases. So when you see someone who's got a febrile illness, nondescript, whether or not they have a rash, in the season when ticks are present and ticks are biting and they've got thrombocytopenia and they're sitting in the emergency department, if they haven't had thrombocytopenia before and you're not sure why they have it, that should trick in the back of your head. Well, maybe that's a little different than a viral syndrome, because we usually just don't see viral syndromes nondescript with a low platelet count. So low platelet count. So that's the end of it. And then some of the other stuff is obvious. You're going to see capillary leak. People will be slightly edematous. You'll see mental status changes, because if you damage the endothelial cell and microcirculation in the brain, you'll see that. You might see meningitis. I'll give you a whole list. Ehrlichias. All the Ehrlichia, which used to be sort of classified with the rickettsia, these are small tick-borne parasites as well, bacterial pathogens, are leukocyte pathogens. So what might you expect as a hallmark of ehrlichiosis? Febrile, flu-like, nondescript illness. Yes, all of these are going to have classic flu symptoms. You know, nondescript, I feel bad, I've got malaise, I have a fever, it comes and goes, I'll have elevated liver function tests. That's true of everything here. It's all flu-like illness, all cytokine driven. But what from the fact that it infects leukocytes, which then causes the leukocytes to rupture, because these are rupturing things, might you expect? Leukopenia. Patient comes in, their leukocyte line is low, besides the fact that they might have AIDS, which in the Bronx is probably a more common cause for lymphopenia. But when you start to see granulocytopenia for no good reason, when you start to see a monocyte, something abnormal in the monocytes, a little bit more difficult to pick up. And then I'll talk a little bit about Coxsilia and Roche-Lemea. Roche-Lemea actually doesn't invade. It's on the surface of the endothelial cells. But what's cool about this pathogen is that Roche-Lemea produces an angiogenesis factor. So it causes a proliferation of the epithelial cells. So when you start to think about the manifestations of Roche Lemea, it's going to look like a tumor because it's producing endothelial cell growth factors. You're going to have proliferation and vascularization and almost a tumor-like effect. And then Coxsellia, which infects macrophages. Macrophages is true for a lot of pathogens. It's kind of a cool little thing. It's always been thrown in with the rickettsia, but it's actually something that's transmitted by aerosol means and not by vectors, even though it is a zoonosis and can cause just about anything, but it's always been thrown in. This, by the way, is the other Q fever. So we've got Q fever and rickettsia for Kew Gardens Cleans, but we've got Q fever, Coxsellia burnetti, and that's for Queensland, Australia, the sheep country, because it's associated with parnition in animals. You find it in placentas of animals. Next slide, please. Enough. So let's talk about Ehrlichia and one of our friends. For those of you that haven't seen one before at this magnification, that's an Oxodes tick. How can you tell it's a tick? Because a tick, like a spider, has 8 legs. Except for the larva, which have 6. But nonetheless, this is getting ready to feed. This is ridges here to give you an idea of size. Next slide, please. So where do we find Ehrlichia? Notice where we are. Nice hot spot. Both human monocytic and human granulocytic ehrlichiosis. And of course, the contrast in your screen isn't good enough to show the colors for some reason. But we're in a hot spot of disease. This corresponds to the distribution of the various ticks. There are 2 different ticks that transmit these diseases. But human granulocytic ehrlichiosis is transmitted by Oxodes ticks. Does anyone recognize Oxodes ticks? Next slide. For what they cause or what they also transmit? These are also called deer ticks. Lyme disease and babesia and ehrlichiosis. So basically, it's an annoying little pathogen. They're all over Westchester County. They're pretty much all over the Bronx as well. There are hot spots of Ehrlichia transmission as well as Lyme transmission within the Bronx in Van Cortlandt Park. If you've ever been up there, it's a gorgeous park up by Montefiore. A lot of ticks in the park. All throughout Westchester, Southern Connecticut, Fire Island, you name it. We're right smack in the middle of tick country. People like to build their houses out where the deer are. The deer are overpopulating. There are no large predators. The deer mice are overpopulating. The ticks are just expanding. It's just a wonderful situation for the ticks. Not such a good situation for us, I suppose. But you can get 3 on a bite. So an Oxodes tick is capable of having all 3 pathogens at the same time, and it's capable of giving you Lyme disease, ehrlichiosis, and babesiosis at the same time. Very good. So this is just a relationship just to sort of show you how Ehrlichia fit with all this. Here's some of our friends down here like Legionella. You can see Coxsellia burnetti, which is often thrown in with the rickettsia, is actually a bit of a distance. But when you get to the rickettsia, they form a nice little clade. And you have the rickettsia, and then you have Ehrlichia, the classic ones found in Japan, and then the 2 species of Ehrlichia found in the United States. And as you can see, the Ehrlichia phagocytophila, which is human granulocytic Ehrlichias, and these 2 others were closely related to Anaplasma, and that's why they've been reclassified. But that's something bacteriologists do, in case you haven't noticed. They love to rename species, as, you know, put together little things. The fact is, nothing has really changed about our understanding. It's just that people realize the relationships and put them together. Chaffinensis is monocytic. Next slide. So where do we see them? How often do we see them? Vectors, Amblyosoma, the Lone Star tick, and several other soft ticks. We already mentioned granulocytic is by Oxodes scapularis. When you look overall, mean age of patients, actually surprisingly, human granulocytic tends to occur in older patients. I don't know why that is, but it just seems to. And in terms of reservoirs and all that, it's pretty much the same thing. Next slide. So how do we make the diagnosis? We already talked about this, flu-like, nondescript illness in season. And what's the season, and how does the season work, and why? So I'm sort of asking you when ticks bite. Well, to some extent, they bite all summer long. Okay, that's true. But the fact is, so let me teach you a little bit about tick biology, because I think it's useful for understanding where you're going to see your peaks of disease, is that ticks generally bite to molt. That says to go between life stages, or to lay eggs, which is equivalent to molting. Oxodes scapularis has a 2-year life cycle. It actually overwinters, it hatches, the eggs feed, the nymphs that come out feed, right? They then go around and molt through a cycle. They become, actually, the larvae that hatch feed. They then molt, become nymphs. They then feed again. They molt again and become adults. The adults the adults ingest and then lay eggs. So when you look at that overall cycle, what basically happens, and the adults tend to be more preferentially, more feed on deer than they do on humans, although these ticks will generally feed on anything. The nymphs are much more voracious coming out from the larva. They'll seek out anything. The density, by the way, is about one tick per square foot through most of Westchester and the lower Bronx when the Fordham people have dragged. If you look carefully at blades of grass, you can see them sort of sitting up at the top, just waiting to crawl. Not to make you upset about going outside. So given those two, and there's a two-year life cycle, you end up with a peak of transmission in the spring when the nymphs are feeding, okay, and a second lower peak of transmission in the fall when the adults are transmitting. So given that it takes a little bit of time for the disease to develop, it's sort of the late spring to early summer is your major peak for most of these Oxodes-transmitted diseases, and then a second peak in sort of the late fall area. Now, does that mean you can't see this all through the summer? No, that doesn't mean that. You know, an occasional tick will feed whenever it had gotten its meal in early spring. It happens to find its first meal, you know, at the beginning of July or something like that. But you should at least be aware that in terms of emergency room visits and hospital visits, that's when you expect your two peaks for Oxodes-related diseases. So these are the manifestations. So this was going to help you find it. Leukopenia, a little bit of thrombocytopenia, liver function abnormalities, alkaline phosphatase being that. And then if you do a peripheral blood examination, in human granulocytic ehrlichiosis in the granulocytes, and in human monocytic ehrlichiosis in the monocytes, this is what you'll see. So this is a little larger than what you might expect from toxic granulations or something else. And what it essentially is within the white blood cell, it's the colony of the bacteria growing. So I told you these are intra-white blood cell pathogens. And these are called morula. And so if you find them, they're useful. In terms of human monocytic, rarely means probably under 2%. If you really look hard in granulocytic, you can find them up to 10% if you look at surveys. But it takes a bit. You have to, if you really want to do this sort of thing, you have to ask the lab to do like a buffy coat prep. You guys know what a buffy coat prep is? Or am I talking old-fashioned medicine that no one does anymore? It's basically you spin down a tube of blood and you take off the white blood cells, which form essentially a white layer between the red blood cells and the serum at the top. You get this kind of white goopy material when you spin down a tube of blood. And that's called the buffy coat, which is essentially enriched for white blood cells. It's just a way of getting all the white blood cells concentrated so you can take a look. So we can do that, and that's low tech. But from a high-tech point of view, you can do PCR. It is circulating in the white blood cells. This can be sent off, and this is probably a useful diagnostic test rapidly. You can do antibody. The minimum peak titer is about 1 to 64 or so. You want to show a four-fold rise. If you get a spot titer that's higher than 1 to 64, it's probably diagnostic of active disease. What's the problem with the antibody titers? It takes a long time for antibody titers to arrive, right? So you got the patient in front of you. They may have a clinical syndrome. You can send off the PCR. That you might get back in 2 or 3 days. The antibody titer you send off, fine. If it's a high titer, single spot, you're useful. If it's a low titer, it's not diagnostic because only in convalescent serology will you be able to make the diagnosis. You can culture these organisms. It requires essentially a viral lab to do so. It's not routine. And the treatment of these organisms is tetracyclines, all right? Doxycycline being drug of choice. Chloramphenicol is very controversial. I don't think any of you have ever used chloramphenicol probably in your career unless you've trained overseas. Okay.
For salmonella.
And overseas, like I said. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with it other than it causes aplastic anemia. If you actually look at the literature and the relative frequency of aplastic anemia relative to, say, severe anaphylaxis with penicillin resulting in death, the frequencies are not that far off. And no one has stopped using penicillin. But the thing with chloramphenicol is we do have a lot of other alternatives, whereas we don't have a lot of alternatives to penicillin derivatives. Rifampin's effective in vitro, but the bottom line is doxycycline is the drug of choice. Since none of you are pediatricians, you don't have to worry about the issue of kids under the age of 7, and you're not going to have, hopefully, very many pregnant women where you need to get a consultation about how do I treat ehrlichiosis when the woman is 3 months pregnant, which gets to be the question of alternative drugs. So when you've got a syndrome, it's compatible, the fever, the leukocytosis, one can essentially put the patient on a tetracycline trial and send off these things. You don't necessarily, and I'm going to come back to that again, when you're pretty sure of the diagnosis or you think it's in the differential, part of the workup does involve the tetracycline trial, which is, I'm not telling you to put every viral syndrome and every fever in the hospital on tetracycline. I'm just pointing out that when you're seriously considering these diagnoses and you're here, by the time you get back some of the confirmatory tests, it takes long enough that it's reasonable to treat empirically based on what it is, particularly with the rickettsia. Next slide. So for those of you that are doubting Thomas's, this just shows you what those morula look like. They are indeed colonies. This is at the EM level, which is just to prove to you that there's bacteria in there. And the dose of doxycycline, you guys know. Next slide. What's that? All right. This was just, yeah, this is a classic tetrad that you should recognize for boards exams and internal medicine and all of that. It's a classic tetrad of babesiosis. And I literally just put that up because of the co-infection rate, which we talked about, and we've already covered this, the fact that Babesia, Ehrlichia, and Lyme run on a match. So if you're entertaining Ehrlichiosis as a diagnosis in a patient, non-monocytic, which is what we mostly see around here, or if you're not sure if it's monocytic or granulocytic, you should always do smears for Babesia, perhaps send serology for Babesia, and also send Lyme serology. Now, the nice thing about doxycycline is that you will treat Lyme as well. You'll actually suppress Babesia, get partial treatment, but it's not the ideal treatment for Babesia, but you'll actually suppress the infection by giving tetracycline to someone with babesiosis. So you do want to make sure they don't have that diagnosis. Just to show you how difficult it can sometimes be to make Ehrlichiosis, about 3 years ago, there was a patient admitted to Montefiore, and the patient was diagnosed as culture-negative endocarditis. Had been in the hospital for, I think, 7 or 8 days at the time they got an infectious disease consultation. And they'd been on broad-spectrum antibiotics, the classic culture-negative sort of thing. They did not have an echo that showed anything, but they essentially had a fever, and they were sick and had a murmur. And they were leukopenic. And the ID fellow, who was very bright at the time, well, I think they're still very bright, but the ID fellow who was sharp, let's put it that way, happened to pick up that this person had visited to Fire Island and that they'd started getting sick about 2 weeks afterwards, and said, well, you know, could this be something like Ehrlichia, because there was, you know, a leukopenia, and no one knew why the patient had a low white count. So they did look, and they weren't sure. They thought they saw a morula, so they put the patient on tetracycline within 48 hours, doxycycline within 48 hours. Patient's fever was gone. They were walking around and all that. So just point out that it is something to keep in the back of your mind, and that it is one of those, you know, imitators. You know, patients do get quite sick with Ehrlichiosis. So that's Babesia. Anyone know how to treat it? If you're going to treat it exactly, next slide. So clindamycin, quinine, etobicoke, azithromycin are acceptable regimens for treating Babesiosis. And I just put this up to teach. This is probably although more expensive, is probably easier to tolerate as an oral regimen. Okay? But both are equally efficacious at eventually resolving Babesiosis, and one gives them for about 7 days. Next slide. All right, so that was Ehrlichia. So let's start talking about the rickettsia, which we were really supposed to talk about. And we're going to start with the spotted fever group, because this is the classic disease of rickettsiosis. But do notice that there's a whole bunch of rickettsia in here. Particularly, there's a lot of, and it's not even in here, there's a lot of African rickettsial disease, and we've seen some people come back with Rickettsia africans and our Conneri, which is also in Africa, come back with rickettsial-like illnesses from overseas trips. So you've got to remember that this can also be a traveler's disease besides acquired by. So this just makes the point that I told you about it being in New York. This was an ID fellow, and there are several other people you may recognize who are still around here, some of whom were also ID fellows and faculty members. But this just reports a focus within New York City, just to tell you that you do not have to go. Not only do you not have to go up to Westchester to get Rocky Fever, you don't actually have to leave New York City. And this focus is in the Bronx, and this is Soundview State Park. Now, so that, you know, one of the things with patients with, again, fever, thrombocytopenia illnesses, they don't have to travel. You have to keep it in your differential, even if they're living within the city. Next slide. So the one important reason why it's important to remember that's always there is rickettsia. In terms of rickettsia, rickettsia is a little bit different in its tics than Oxoides. And although I didn't tell you it, in Oxoides tics, right, I sort of implied it, but in Oxoides tics, the disease is not transmitted through the egg. So, you know, it doesn't go tick to tick to tick to tick to tick through the eggs. And that's why when I told you about the larva and the nymphs, I said that the nymphs feeding and the adults feeding was where you got transmission. But I ignored the larva, which hatch out of the eggs. Because the larva, to complete the cycle for Oxoides, for Ehrlichia, for Lyme, and all of that, the larva need to feed on something infected in the environment. And that's where the deer mouse comes in perpetuating a lot of those diseases. The deer mouse is the asymptomatic zoonotic reservoir. Most of the rickettsia, however, and particularly rickettsia rickettsiae, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, actually goes tick to tick to tick to tick to tick. And it goes through the eggs. So that the larva, the ticks are essentially born infected. So once you get an infected focus somewhere, it really does tend to perpetuate itself in the area. So even though that article I showed you was from 1988, 20 years ago, describing a focus of rickettsia in the Bronx, in Soundview Park, there are still infected ticks there, and it's not just because there are mice and other things that they can feed on, you know, and it's not going back and forth between all these animals, but it's also because it can go tick to tick to tick to tick to tick. Next cycle. So this is the type of tick that transmits, just to give you an idea. Anyone know what type of tick dermacentors are, classically called? Dog ticks. So no one has dogs, walks them in the park, never picks ticks off them. These are bigger ticks. So the Oxoides tick, the little Lyme tick, has anyone seen one of those? Okay, a distended, fully fed one is about the size of a pencil eraser. And, you know, the other ones are, you know, you can easily fit an adult tick that's not been feeding. You can see it, you know, right across the top of a pencil. Dog ticks, on the other hand, when they're fully distended and fed, are about the size of the top of my thumb. All right, so this is a much bigger tick that runs around. So they're a little easier to find. So while the Oxoides ticks, people often don't know they've been bitten by them, usually people have an idea that they've been bitten by one of these ticks because they're a little bit bigger. Next slide. And this is what happens, although not found in Rocky Mountain spotted fever. For all of the other rickettsia, when you're trying to make a diagnosis, this is what you're going to look for as much as anything else. So for typhus, for all other rickettsia, for even for Tsutagamushi fever, for Q fever or rickettsia pox, you'll see something like this: a punched out sore on the skin. And that eschar is because why? Where do rickettsia replicate? What? Right, vasculitis, endothelial cell. The tick bites, puts in lots of organisms. They replicate locally. They cause the endothelial cells to be damaged. They essentially cause a little infarct in the skin. There you are. You don't tend to see it in rickettsia, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, because it tends to disseminate a little bit quicker. But most of the other rickettsia replicate locally for a long enough period of time before dissemination that you see these punched out eschars. And finding one doesn't rule out Rocky Mountain. It's just not often found in that setting. Next slide. So this is the rash of Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And most other rickettsia that behave like it, like African tick fever and so on and so forth. And this is on the eighth day, and this is a young child. They don't fade on pressure. And characteristic of this rash also, sort of shown here? Palms and soles. All right, don't we always teach rashes on the palms and soles are rare. Right? What else gives you a rash on the palms and soles? Syphilis. Syphilis and atypical measles. You know, actually, measles secondary vaccination. This is kids' diseases, right? Occasionally, Boston exanthem. But in terms of adults, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, which is petechial, and syphilis, which is more of a circular dime-like lesion or heaped-up margins or what have you. What else do you notice about this particular rash, besides the fact that it's non-blanching and petechial, is that it does tend to spread from the outside in. Not terribly useful in diagnosis because, you know, sometimes you can get that story, but, you know, usually it's more peripheral than central as opposed to spreading central to out. And you can see over here, you notice how dark these fingertips are. So this is the eighth day. Next slide. This is a patient at Jacoby. Okay? This is 5 years ago in the ICU here. And so here's your rash. Petechial, right? Petechial. Those fingers are going to be gone. Okay? So, what is the mortality rate from Rocky Mountain spotted fever? High or low? It's untreated, it's considerably high, 1 in 4 or higher, right? Treated, it's still 5%. Damage rates are even higher. So it is a medical emergency, and you don't want to let the rash progress from early to late stages going on with this systemic vasculitis while you're necessarily waiting for your diagnostic tests to come back. So how might you diagnose Rocky Mountain spotted fever? Next slide. Rapidly. So you could send a PCR. Not terribly rapid. We could do serology, and you should definitely do that, right? But what are the problems with both of those tests? Turnaround time, right? And serology needs 4 weeks for convalescence. So how could you make the diagnosis very rapidly? Well, you got a rash, right? Biopsy the rash. What do you see here? I know none of you are pathologists, but... It's hard to tell because of the projection here, but this is a capillary and it's completely occluded. So it's a vasculitis. And you can actually stain, and here, very hard to see, but I'm going to point it out to you because you can do this with immune fluorescence, you can do this with just regular antibodies. This is rickettsia within the endothelial cells. So what you can do to diagnose rickettsia rapidly, and what you should do, is get a skin biopsy and ask it to be worked up for rickettsia. Within 24 to 48 hours, you can have a direct diagnosis of rickettsia. Now, should you wait to treat the patient until you get your results back in general? No. I'm just, again, coming back to the point. Not that I want you to sprinkle doxycycline in the water, but if you have a characteristic syndrome and so on, you know, you start treating at the time you make your diagnosis. Next slide. So what are the signs and symptoms? So here is 78 patients with rash. And I told you that about 10% don't have it, but then we're just going to look at the rash patients now. What might you expect to see? Well, we talked about this is an endothelial cell pathogen. I think you could probably reduplicate this without even thinking. Right? Because you know what endothelial cell toxicity would do. Periorbital edema, edema of the extremity, splenomegaly, hepatosplenomegaly, abdominal tenderness, meningeal signs, and conjunctivitis. Pretty much if you think through what's going to happen if you damage endothelial cell diffusely as a vasculitis, you can recreate this. If you see the overall number, conjunctivitis, meningitis, about 10%, right? Fever, rash, in this case 100% just because it was done that way. Next slide. Diagnosis we just talked about, you can do direct culture, this testing. PCR is no longer experimental, but not widely done. Anyone know what the Weill Felix test is? I always mention it because I think it still occasionally appears on board exams.
Something like cross reaction with Proteus or something.
Yeah. So every once in a while it still appears. I don't think any of you have ever sent it. I don't even know if you can order it anymore because we do have specific tests for rickettsia. We have complement fixation widely available in most places. So if you send a rickettsial panel, they'll ask you, what do you want? You know, you want Rocky Mountain, you want this, and some of them cross react. But in general, there are large groups. All the rickettsia that are like Rocky Mountain spotted fever sort of cross-reacting, give you comp fix positives and things like that, as opposed to Oriental Pseudogumushi, scrub typhus, or typhus group, which gives you another. But the Weill Felix is exactly that. It's Proteus cross-react. People who got Rocky Mountain spotted fever, or actually typhus, which is where it was developed, turned out to have antibodies that cross-reacted with various strains of Proteus. And so they made an agglutination test based on three strains of Proteus, and whether it agglutinates one strain or the other can sort of put you into different groups of rickettsia, the Rocky Mountain spotted fever, the typhus group, or the other group. And it's interesting from a historical point of view. It used to be called febrile agglutinins, and it's interesting historically also in that it was used to create false epidemics of typhus during World War II by some physicians in order to try and save whole towns from Nazi occupation, because the Nazis didn't want to move in and deport people who had typhus and then mess up the work camps by having diseases. So the local doctors sometimes, there's a couple of well-published little stories of them creating false epidemics by basically immunizing patients with Proteus, then sending the serology off to be tested, showing that typhus was still active in the area, and therefore no one wanted to come in and have war, a sort of deportation at that point. So it's some interesting history there. Anyway, but you should at least know what it was, because occasionally it shows up on board exams. Next slide. So how do we treat it? We talked about it. Tetracyclines are drugs of choice. Chloramphenicol has a use here if you had, this is where, if you had a child under the age of 7, you know, when you thought they had Rocky Mountain spotted fever, no one would blink twice about giving them chloramphenicol in the, intravenously or orally for that matter, but probably intravenously for the treatment of Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Quinolones have variable effects here. So some people have talked about using quinolones because, again, they are drugs that are active against internal targets for the treatment of rickettsias. And when they've been looked at for Rocky Mountain spotted fever, they're really quite variable. So I wouldn't recommend reaching to it for drug of choice. And beta-lactams in general are not effective against intracellular organisms like this. So even though these are gram-negative organisms, if you look at them carefully in terms of their cell walls, all of the classic antibiotics we use for the treatment of bacteria, which are based on cell walls, are inactive against these obligate intracellular organisms. You have to target internal protein synthesis machinery in order to kill. That's what doxycycline does. That's what chloramphenicol does. So the drugs that target internal structures are the drugs that are active here. Next slide. All right, so that was the spotted fever group. And we move on to the typhus group over here. And that includes a whole bunch of things, scrub typhus and what have you. Again, all over the United States, very similar things. You're going to see a rash. You'll see thrombocytopenias. You'll see a nondescript fever. That should lead you to believe typhus. Then how do you decide which you send and what tests you send? To some extent, depends on the epidemiology. Where has the patient been? Have they traveled? Are they homeless? Those are going to lead you to different diagnoses, perhaps, based on what it is. Again, we only have so much time. I don't want to go into each disease in great and overwhelming detail. Next slide. So here we are again. What do you see? An Eschker. So this is a patient who came in from Southeast Asia. I took this out of a book. Southeast Asia travel. This was something that we saw in the Vietnam War, not infrequently. Patient comes in with febrile illness, a little mild thrombocytopenia, a little bit of liver disease, and a diffuse rash. It is petechial in that it doesn't blanch, but these sort of scrub typhus and typhus rashes tend not to progress like Rocky Mountain spotted fever does to those really sort of diffuse gangrene type of presentations. They're a little bit subtler, but they are clear, they are petechial. So that patient comes in there. You can send off serology, specific complement fixation, and all the rest. Put on doxycycline, the fever disappears. Next slide. And this is an example of the rash. Then see how much subtler this is. Small little petechiae. You might even think this is a little bit of a folliculitis, but you can see it's all throughout associated with the fever. Just giving you little pointers. So not quite the sort of rash that I was showing you before, but you can see the same sort of rash. Next slide. So our friend over here, typhus. This is the disease of Napoleon, right? And I'm showing you another friend over here because we used to say that typhus was a human disease only. So it was human transmission in some way, human to human, through body lice. All right? Anyone know what a body louse is? Any of you guys taking care of really homeless patients with body lice? Didn't work down the ED, or by the time the patients get up to you, they're deloused. I guess they're deloused. So body lice are an insect, a biting insect, and they do not live on the human body. They feed on us, but they don't live on us. What they live on is our clothes. So they'll live in the seams of clothing, they'll live on dirty clothing, and that's why body lice are associated with homelessness, war, dispossession. You know, you're basically wearing the same clothes all the time, you're never washing them. It gives an opportunity for the insects to infiltrate the clothing, live in there, lay their eggs, and then come onto you to bite. A little bit gross, right? But this is life. Okay? So that cycle of person-to-person transmission through lice was believed to be the only way that typhus, Rickettsia prosecki, kept. However, about a decade ago, it was recognized that there is indeed a zoonotic reservoir of typhus as well, and at least in the United States, the zoonotic reservoir is this little bugger, which is the flying squirrel. So typhus is not just a human disease also, but it's also another zoonosis, as is all the diseases I'm showing you today. And that zoonotic thing means not only do they go through an insect, but if you go out into the environment, there are animal reservoirs of these diseases, and if humans weren't involved, these diseases would still stick around because they're going to go between the animals and the insects and have nothing to do with us. So it's the same thing with typhus. Next slide. So this is a human body louse to give you an idea what it looks like. It looks kind of like a crab except a little elongated. Next slide. And this is an example of the rash. So a patient with typhus, same thing, endothelial cell pathogen, not much different. Again, fever, nondescript illness, a little bit of thrombocytopenia, liver function abnormalities, pretty much all the same things. You know, the symptoms here are relatively nondescript with some clues, but they will develop a rash. It is non-blanching, erythematous, and macule, but it is much finer in this petechial thing. And you can sort of see a little bit of a slapped face on this individual, right? And you see this very, very fine rash. Get a feel for it. It's unfortunately the production here. Again, doxycycline goes away, diagnosis, we've talked about serology and what have you. Interesting thing about typhus is it has an ability to go latent in humans. And this is why humans are actually also a reservoir host for this disease. We don't see it that often anymore, although with displaced persons, we may start to see it again. But especially after World War II, you had a lot of people who had typhus. Right? Some of whom weren't treated, they got nutrition, they got better, they got over it. Then when these individuals from World War II get to be about 80 years old, give or take, they get sick, they get mildly immunocompromised, they can actually get spontaneous relapse of typhus, even though they've never been exposed to it, with bacteremia, typhemia, rickettsiemia to be precise, and they become a reservoir from which the insects could bite and then respread the disease. And that's recurrent illness is sometimes called Brill-Zillner disease. So you can see recurrent typhus in people who haven't exposed. But most of the cases, you know, 99% of the cases you see nowadays are prime infection. And there will be some sort of history of homelessness, displaced, some reason why they're being exposed to louse. Okay, next, and louse feces. So that's it for the classic stuff. Now I just want to tell you a little bit about rickettsia pox. And here's the actual article. Took it out of the library and Xeroxed it from our library over at Einstein. New York Medicine, it was published in 1946. Forget about syphilis. Kew Gardens spotted, this is me circling it, it wasn't in color back then. Kew Gardens spotted fever. Great story. Exterminator goes in to many, many buildings because he's being called for mouse problems and notices that he's visiting people and they're sick and they have chickenpox, which the exterminator thought was kind of odd because he didn't usually see adults with chickenpox. And in fact, when the health department went in and investigated it, this was very atypical chickenpox, and it turned out that all of these patients, all these people in Queens, were having a newly recognized rickettsial illness that was coming into their house from the mice and is transmitted from the mites that feed on the mice, which are basically a small version of a tick. That, if you remember in any of that story, you can actually diagnose this disease because you'll know that it'll look a little like chickenpox, isolated little lesions with a little vesicle in a febrile patient. Next slide. So this is a child with it, little vesicular. Again, these are, and I'll show you a biopsy of them, these are actually petechial-like lesions, in that when you biopsy them and you actually look at them, there's endothelial pathogens, there's obstruction of the vessels, and there's, you know, all the sort of fibrinous deposits. So the pathogenesis that I'm telling you to keep in your mind is the same. But in this particular case, the sort of fine point is they do develop these little vesicles, so they look a little like chicken pox. The other thing is that this disease is often associated as a clinical pearl with a lot of back pain. So patients really complain almost like the worst back pain and aches of their back of their life, and then they have these few little lesions, and that's a tip-off that they might have rickettsia pox. Specific serology can be sent. Patients who are presenting with the disease usually have a positive serology to make the diagnosis. It's another one of the rickettsial diseases that, again, starting doxycycline within 48 or so hours after starting doxycycline, the patient's back pain is gone, their fevers are gone, they're feeling great, they're up, and they're ready to dance. Other things, you know, obviously you see a child, you believe this might be chicken pox, right? Chicken pox you can distinguish from this because chicken pox comes out in crops of lesions of varying ages and so on. But this would be, might be a hard call. But if you see an adult with this, you begin to get more suspicious. Although I will comment that adults from other countries who immigrate to the United States are likely to get chicken pox as adults. Right, because in many other parts of the world, chickenpox is not universally seen in children, whereas we have a lot of it in this country, particularly circulating around children. So young adults who come to the United States, 20, 30, 40 years old, often get or can get chickenpox in their first exposure. So you do see chickenpox in adults and immigrants. Next slide. So just to show you, you know, again, this is hard to show with this, but this, go to the next slide, is the area of vasculitis. You come up on it. An obstructed vessel stained here, just showing that there's rickettsia in it. Same pathophysiology, same disease. Different degrees of mild and severity, right? This is not going to progress like Rocky Mountain spotted fever to necrosis of digits. It's not as prolific. It's not going into every vascular bed. This tends to stick pretty much to the skin, although if you carefully look, these patients with rickettsia pox sometimes have liver function abnormalities and a little bit of thrombocytopenia and the like. Next slide. Again, just another one showing you onion skinning and the sort of obstructed vessel. This is just to prove to you that I'm not crazy, that these diseases are all the same. Next slide. Okay, management of that disease, same as all the other rickettsia. See, rickettsia is really easy, right? All you got to remember is doxycycline. Anything atypical gets doxycycline. You're done, you know. I don't know what it is, but I'm going to give the patient doxycycline. Yeah, secret of ID. It's kind of like dermatology. You rub a little bit of whatever cream you want. You know, if it itches, you know, you rub a little antifungal cream. If it doesn't work, you put a little steroid cream on top of it. You know, figure out the diagnosis when you biopsy it. And those of you that are budding dermatologists, don't take that the wrong way. I actually respect dermatology quite a bit. It's a really tough field. So the last rickettsia is Coxsellia burnetii, and it really isn't a rickettsia. It's traditionally thrown in with the rickettsia, and I just want to talk to you about it because it comes up on all sorts of things. But as opposed to all the other rickettsia, and this is just put up here to just give you an idea, there's a huge number of ticks that can transmit this. I mean, it's almost not tick species specific. There's a lot of animals that come in and transmit it. And it's classically associated with parnition in animals. That is, when they give birth, the placentas are infected. And it's transmitted by aerosol, and it can be transmitted by ingestion of food or water sources. So you can get Q fever from just about anything. And unlike the other rickettsia, it's capable of surviving extracellularly in the environment. You know, it doesn't require all of these sort of things. So it's a very different sort of organism, but it's classically grouped into here. It can cause all sorts of clinical syndromes. Hepatitis, endocarditis, osteomyelitis, FUO. Culture-negative endocarditis is one of the classic causes is Q fever. It's zoonotic. It's cattle, sheep, and goats. That being said, there's this wonderful case in the New England Journal of Medicine from like 15 years ago in Newfoundland where a cat comes in while this group are playing their weekly poker game and gives birth in the corner of the kitchen. And everyone gets Q fever in the room from the cat giving birth because the cat had Q fever. And it was transmitted by aerosol from the placenta in the birth process. So it's basically you know, capable of aerosol transmission all the way. It's got a really neat little bit of biology in that it actually lives in phagosomes. It's kind of cool. It's a pathogen that's adopted a strategy of liking low pH. It actually needs acid to grow properly. So it's a phagosome resident pathogen. It's kind of cool. Basic biology doesn't have much to do with the medicine. But the thing that has to do with the medicine that you should remember is this whole phase one, phase two thing, which is an antigenic shift feature, which is that within animals it expresses different proteins, which they call phase one in Coxsellia, and those are virulence, as opposed to phase two, which are established in culture. And the reason why this is interesting is this is one of the few diseases like syphilis where serology correlates with active disease. It's really unusual. You know, so syphilis, we have what, right? We have the VDRL, the RPR, which is actually reacts to cardiolipin, right? Which is not even a syphilis antigen. It's a cross reaction. But that serological response is only present with the activity of syphilis. And, you know, the worse the syphilis in terms of, you know, primary, secondary disease, you know, 1 to 1,000, I've never seen that, but 1 to 256, 1 to 512, pretty common. As you treat the syphilis, that disappears. In a similar sort of sense for Q fever, if you send phase antigen antibody and you get a phase one reactive serology, a positive serology, it does not just mean you've been exposed. It actually means you've got active replication and active disease. All right? So it's very useful, one of the few things where the serology makes the diagnosis besides culture. Next slide. Fell asleep? No, there we go. Sorry. I'm trying not to make you guys go to sleep. I apologize. So acute infection, it's a respiratory pathogen. Hey, don't mind me. I'll bring out my other jokes too. This wasn't directed at you. So the acute infection from an aerosol, what might you expect? Now you know the biology. Aerosol transmission. Viral-like syndrome and... pneumonia, pneumonitis. So that's what it causes, a flu-like illness, a little bit of hepatitis as it disseminates. If you do an x-ray, you see pneumonia. Chronically, just think of any bacteria. Okay, anything can be in the differential. Classically, you'll come up with it as either an FUO or a culture-negative endocarditis. But, you know, when you take a history of a patient, if you've done the things and the staph aureus isn't coming out on the osteo, or, you know, they've got a weird neurological disease, meningitis, and no, nothing's coming out, a little bit of history, you know, ever around animals, ever on a farm, you know, ever around pregnant animals, sounds like stupid questions, but, you know, these are the ways that sort of pick up, besides just routinely sending the serology on everybody, which has its problems in false negatives and false positives. So, as I said, the comp fix phase one is diagnostic. Next slide. All right, treatment here is a little bit different. In that, besides our standback tetracycline, we can end up here using trimethoprim, rifampin, and quinolones as well. All of these are active. We use an awful lot of quinolones in the hospital, so we may inadvertently treat the few rare cases that come through by using our quinolones for febrile patients with what have you. But nonetheless, all of these are active. And about 2 weeks for acute disease, but endocarditis can take about 2 years to cure. Again, this is a disease when you come around to it, you're going to look it up, you know, if you really make the diagnosis in terms of duration, and get a consult, mainly because we like to see rare stuff too. Next slide. All right, this is the last thing I'm going to talk to you about, and then we're done, and I promise to finish 5 minutes late, because I started 5 minutes late, but if anyone has to go, please, I will not take offense. So here's a picture. What do you see? Nodules. Reddish nodules all over the face. Now, of course, we're talking about infectious diseases, and those of you that were awake at the very beginning may have remembered the bottom of my slide, and I mentioned this thing that's called Bartonella, which I said were really cool because they make growth factors, and they cause self-limited tumors. So this is bacillary angiomatosis, proliferation of angiomatous plaques all throughout the skin due to a bacteria. And that's actually the way it was recognized in the setting of HIV. The beginning of the epidemic, I'd say about 1988 was where there were a peak of reporting of this. Kaposi's sarcoma, another angiomatous proliferation due to a virus, but this due to a bacteria. People started seeing this, and they didn't really know what caused it. Had no idea. Special stains with silver, they could see bacteria in these lesions. But they did know that if you gave macrolides, azithromycin, this tended to get better. Next slide. And here's another example of one. You can see this is just proliferative little lesion associated with fever. Another one on the skin there that looks almost like a wart. Next slide. Another one. Next slide. You also can see these in the liver, proliferative pileosis hepatica type lesions, just to give you the idea of the differential. These will be febrile patients, often immune compromised. Next slide. And they can cause osteomyelitis or skin lesions, same sort of thing. Next slide. And if you biopsy it and you're staying with silver, you see the bacteria on silver stain. People couldn't quite figure out what bacteria it is. They went to a really cool technique, next slide, where they amplified the bacteria by using non-specific PCR primers to the ribosomal RNA genes, basically trying to fish out unknown bacteria in a clinical sample. It's a really neat trick from microbiology, how people sort of look for things that are unknown in the environment and put them up against the tree of life, all the sequences of bacteria, see what you get, build up phylogenies. And surprisingly enough, they came up with a new species in the Bartonella henselae, and Bartonella quintana, which was previously known as Roche lamea, was over here. This is another, quote, Q fever. In this case, it's trench fever, which was a disease known in World War II, associated with homelessness and trench warfare, kind of those things that cause lice, right, and human louse transmission, as a febrile, nondescript illness responsive to macrolides. And then Bartonella bacilliformis down here, related to all of them, which is what renamed the whole thing, which is a really interesting disease called Araya fever, found in the Andes. And what's cool about this, besides the fact that it was worked out by a medical student as to what caused it, who unfortunately ended up killing themselves by self-experimentation, by injecting themselves with bacteria and then developing a fatal illness, but nonetheless did prove it, I guess that's dedication to your task, is that if you had thought from the beginning and sort of knew a little bit about tropical diseases and seeing this disease, you might have actually thought that this was indeed the relative. Because next slide, I think I've got a picture. This is Verruca planus, which is from the Andes. This is Bartonella bacilliformis in its chronic stage. This is where the medical student died. In the acute phase, bartonellosis, actually see it in the red blood cells. It's the only bacteria I know, one, where you can see it in the blood, and two, that goes into red blood cells. You know, you get malaria in there, but to find a bacteria in red blood cells, and this is a bacteria pathogen, but it does eventually go and produce this endothelial cell adherence. And you see all these little plaques. Looks familiar, right? And so this is a disease that was known all the way back into the 20s, but people sort of, blinders on, AIDS patients, proliferation, well, you know, no one sort of thought of this funny disease in the Andes, which they knew was transmitted by sandfly bites and all of that. Next slide. So we now know that there's a whole bunch. We have this one Verruca or Araya fever down in the Andes. We have B. henselae, which we now know is transmitted by fleas associated with cats, and this causes bacillary angiomatosis, probably also responsible for lymph node hypertrophy related to cat bites, what's called cat scratch disease, and trench fever, which is the B. quintana sort of thing. All of them are responsive to macrolides. That's what you should remember as the drugs of choice, azithromycin, somewhat responsive to doxycycline as well. Next slide. And then the cat flea, for those of you who've never seen one, that's what transmits that. They like to bite us too. So that, you know, next slide. The antibiotics, chloramphenicol also has effectiveness, beta-lactam's not, quinolone's variable. So these are the ones to remember, bartonellosis, doxy, erythrone, macrolides. And I'd say for most cases, macrolides, azithromycin is the drug of choice, and doxy would be now considered second. So I didn't want to go too much further, but I'm open to questions. I hope it was at least entertaining, if it wasn't educational. And the next slide, I think there might be one left. And so we can go off now and examine everything that I've told you, sort through it, decide what you want to keep and what you want to throw. But what would you like to talk about? You can turn on the lights. I'm done. Any questions? Nothing? Okay. So I either bored you to death or it was at least entertaining. Ciao.
Thank you.
I hope I covered what you guys wanted in the